Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Cotton is an integral part of our everyday lives. You're probably wearing it. It's so ubiquitous as to be almost invisible. But according to today's guest, Professor Sven Beckert, cotton provides the key to understanding the modern world, the great inequalities that characterize it, the long history of globalization, and modern capitalism. In his new book, Empire of Cotton, he writes, quote, "This is the story of the rise and fall of the European-dominated empire of cotton. But because of the centrality of cotton, its story is also the story of the making and remaking of global capitalism, and with it, of the modern world. Foregrounding a global scale of analysis, we will learn how, in a remarkably brief period, enterprising entrepreneurs and powerful statesmen in Europe recast the world's most significant manufacturing industry by combining imperial expansion and slave labor with new machines and wage workers." So how does the history of cotton help us understand the history of capitalism and its evolution to neoliberal capitalism? Sven Beckert is professor of American history at Harvard University, and he's the author of Empire of Cotton, A Global History. It's the first global history of the 19th century's most important commodity. And Sven joins us from his office at Harvard. Hi, Sven. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Good morning. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. What an amazing book.
Thank you.
Really, congratulations. You spent 10 years on this book. It's about 440 pages with about 100 pages of notes. So incredibly researched. You went to every continent to research your book. Talk a little bit about how you first got the idea to focus on cotton to tell the story of modern capitalism.
Yeah, that is an interesting question, and in some ways, I was trained as a historian of the United States. I was interested in the history of capitalism in the United States in the 19th century. I wrote another book on this topic, and when I was done with that, I decided that you cannot really understand the development of American capitalism or the history of the United States without putting it into some kind of global context. And obviously, that global context is potentially vast and could potentially include everything, and it would thus be quite unwieldy and would also take much more than 10 years to research and to write. And so I decided one way to tell a history of the United States in global perspective and to tell a global history of capitalism is to focus on a commodity, on a thing, and then trace that thing, trace that commodity to whatever places it might take me. And if you look at the United States in the 19th century, and if you look at the world during the past 900 years, you cannot help but see that the central commodity in that history, in that history of capitalism, is cotton. And so I decided that I'm going to try to tell a history of global capitalism through the history of cotton.
And many books have been written about cotton. Can you talk about what is missing from those books? Because you write about so many books take a look at the commodity trade from India to Africa and to the Americas, slavery in the United States. What's really missing from those?
I think what we are missing mostly is that global context. So there are there are dozens, hundreds of books on the slave plantations of the American South. There are hundreds of books on the industrialization in New England. There are hundreds of books on the Industrial Revolution in the United Kingdom. There are hundreds of books on the Indian cotton industry and, as you mentioned, trade between India and Africa and Africa and Europe. But I think it is quite impossible to understand any local, regional, or national aspect of the history of this industry without putting it into a global context. So, for example, the most obvious example is the history of the expansion and intensification of slavery in the American South. This expansion of slavery was nearly exclusively related to the expansion of cotton agriculture. Ever more American slaves grew ever more cotton, and they grew that cotton for world markets. But why was there such a demand for cotton? It was a result of the Industrial Revolution that had taken place in England and later spread to continental Europe and also the northern United States. So without putting the expansion of slave agriculture in the American South into that greater global context, it is impossible to understand the local story you want to tell.
And also, some people might be wondering, why cotton and not other commodities like sugar or rice? And you write that rice cultivation in the Americas did not lead to an explosion of both slavery and wage labor. Cotton did. As a result, cotton spanned the globe unlike any other industry. Can you tell us a little bit more about the major differences between cotton and these other commodities?
Yes. So they obviously, if you look at the history of the word, there are other commodities that are very, very global, and you just mentioned rice, which is certainly one of them, but you could also in particular look at the history of sugar, which connects European consumers to slaves deported from Africa to plantations in the Americas. But I think cotton is in a quite fundamental way different from these other commodities, and that is that cotton is really at the center of the emergence of modern industrial capital. It is the commodity that goes into the Industrial Revolution and thus into forging the world in which we in some ways live to this day. So it combines the history of cotton is a way to be able to show, on the one hand, the vast expansion of slave agriculture and coercive labor regimes in the countryside all over the world, but combining that with the expansion of industrial capitalism, the emergence of factories, the emergence of wage workers, the huge productivity gains that went along with that. And so in some ways, the history of cotton allows us to make the history of capitalism whole instead of just telling a part of it.
And there's so many discussions about capitalism now. I mean, we had a lot during Occupy. But when people think about the history of capitalism, the visions that come up are, like you write in your book, images of coal mines, railroads, giant steelworks. And you say that one reason it's hard to see cotton's importance is because it's been overshadowed in our collective memory by these images. And industrial capitalism's more tangible, more massive manifestations. Yeah. And so we don't really think about cotton when we think about the history of capitalism.
Right. That is very, very true. And in some ways, it's surprising. Obviously, if you look at the world today, the cotton industry is not at the very center of global capitalism today. But it is still to this day, it is amazingly important. There are estimates that up to 350 million people in the world today, in one way or another, are engaged with cotton. They grow it, they transport it, they gin it, they spin it, they weave it, and they manufacture it into textiles. That is a very, very significant share of the total human population. And if you look back into the 18th century, the 19th century, or the beginnings of the 20th century, cotton was even more important to this particular history. But in some ways, we have, as you mentioned, we have somehow persuaded ourselves not to think of that history when we think about industrial capitalism, and instead we like to think, if we don't think about Silicon Valley, which many people prefer to think about, but if we don't think about Silicon Valley, you might still then prefer to think about Pittsburgh and steelworks and the huge expansion of wage workers and all of that. But the history of capitalism is also a history that is a history of the expansion of slavery, the enormous violence in the global countryside, and thus it is, in some ways, the history of cotton allows us to get at something that is at the very core of the long history of capitalism. And I think, just to add to that, it is also important to remember that in the history of the world before the Industrial Revolution, in the couple of hundred years, 700, 900 years before the Industrial Revolution, the manufacturing of cotton textile was already the most important industry that humans engaged in. And it was largely concentrated in places such as India, China, East Africa, and Central America. And thus, the recasting of what was then already the most important industry is of particular importance to the history of the globe.
I also appreciate that you bring gender into this. You write that we tend to recall industrial capitalism as male-dominated, whereas women's labor largely created the empire of cotton.
Right. Yeah, so if we think about steelworks, if we think about mechanical engineering companies, car manufacturers, the things that usually come to mind when we think about industrial capitalism, we largely think about male workers, skilled male workers, or maybe even unskilled male workers, but male workers. But the cotton industry, the manufacturing part of the cotton industry, from its inception to today, was always decisively dominated by women. At the beginning, mostly by children and women, and then eventually mostly by adult women.
I'm speaking with Harvard professor Sven Beckert about his new book, Empire of Cotton, A Global History. He writes, quote, "Too often we prefer to erase the realities of slavery, expropriation, and colonialism from the history of capitalism, craving a nobler, cleaner capitalism," end quote. So Sven says that in order to really understand modern capitalism, we need to look at the history of cotton. This is probably something you haven't really thought much about, and it's such an important and integral part of our everyday lives. We take it for granted. So what questions do you have about cotton and what it tells us about modern capitalism, the great inequalities that characterize it, the long history of globalization? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Sven spent 10 years researching this book. He traveled to every continent to do research and to do interviews. Sven, again, it's a massive book. We embark on a journey through 5,000 years of human history. I really want to talk about, you know, sort of modern time, but it's also important to go back there because it really does shape the way we got here. What really stood out for you in terms of what we need to understand when you look at the countries that were the major producers of cotton in the beginning?
I mean, the one really fascinating issue is how this global cotton industry, which I mentioned before, was so important to human manufacturing activities before the Industrial Revolution, how that came to be located mostly in the continent of Europe, and then also how the United States became important to this history. Because for the first 700-800 years of the history of the global cotton industry, its center was decisively in Asia, and especially in South Asia. And so looking at cotton, looking at this particular commodity, allows you to understand how the global economy, how the center of the global economy shifted from where it had been for a long time, namely in Asia, especially what is now India and China, into Western Europe and the United States. And it helps us answer a question that is one of the most important questions that historians can possibly ask, namely, why is it that some parts of the world became so rich while other parts of the world remained so poor? And then I think the history of cotton also tells you a lot of things about how to understand capitalism. It is not an abstract story about capitalism. It's not a kind of Adam Smithian theorizing about the ideal typical workings of capitalism. But instead, it is an effort to understand capitalism historically, to understand capitalism as capitalism in action, as I put it, as something that, you know, actually an actual history of what happened in this unfolding of capitalism. And it shows, among other things, when we think about capitalism, we like to think about markets, we like to think about contracts, we like to think about the rule of law, we like to think about wage labor, and most importantly, we like to think about capitalism as an expansion of human freedom. And obviously this is partly very true. Capitalism did go along with an expansion of human freedom. There is the rule of law, contracts and markets and wage labor all matter to the history of capitalism. But if you look at the history of capitalism in action, if you look at the history of capitalism in action through the history of cotton, you see that to that story, what also matters to this story to a great degree is an enormous degree of coercion, of violence, of land expropriations, of slavery and other such things.
Well, we have full lines, so let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from Kathy in Oakland. Hi, Kathy. Welcome to the show. Hello, Kathy.
I'm Kathy from Santa Cruz.
Oh, hi. Go ahead, Kathy.
Oh, I'm very interested in the modern situation with cotton. I noticed that clothing, especially women's clothing that is made now, is made with a very long, silky fiber. And I understand that this is a very special strain of cotton that has been patented by Monsanto. And it's the situation where they sell the farmers the seeds, and then when the farmers go bankrupt because they can't really afford the seeds, they appropriate their land. And this is happening in northern India.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you could explain that situation further, and so I can see if I understand it correctly.
Right, thank you. These are really, really terrific questions and also very large questions. So I mean, to begin with, I think you're exactly right. There are very different kinds of cottons in the world, of very different qualities, and the quality is mostly related to the length of the staple. And some of the best cottons are grown, especially in Egypt, which is famous for its long staple cottons. So this was the case throughout the history of cotton, and in some ways, American cotton producers in the 19th century and beyond focused especially on relatively short staple cotton, unlike the producers in Egypt and elsewhere. The story about GMO cotton is a much more recent one, though one has to say that in the past, in the 200 years of the history of cotton, there have always been efforts and successful efforts to breed different strains of cotton. And in some ways, one of the very big stories of the global history of capitalism, global history of cotton, and the global history of capitalism and cotton, is the spread of particular strains of cotton into many different parts of the world. So particular strains of American cotton that originates from the United States is now grown in many, many different parts of the world. So there's kind of an acceleration of the spread of biological matters through the world as part of this expansion of capitalism. But the GMO cottons, this is a much more recent development, and I'm not a great expert in this story, but what you mentioned about the fate of farmers in India is exactly true, and it's actually a story that I'm telling in this book. There are many, many farmers who are very highly indebted to seed merchants and thus to these big multinational seed companies, and there have been many cases in which farmers in India have committed suicide by drinking their own pesticides. Mm. So this is a huge story.
And since you brought up India, can you talk a little bit about how England approached India and the relationship that it had with India? You write that the ways cotton was produced in India never meshed well with the particular needs of modern European spinning factories. Indeed, in regions where cotton was grown by peasant labor, European capital did not reach the producers. Instead, local growers retained sufficient control over their land and labor to escape the monocultural production of cotton for global markets, and indigenous merchants' production of cotton. Indigenous merchants retained control over the internal cotton trade and even exports.
Right. So I think the quote just summarizes that story pretty well. But basically, the one of the great puzzles that this book is trying to solve is why became slave labor, so important to this history of cotton during the moment of the Industrial Revolution. Because in some ways it's puzzling. The United States did not produce much cotton for world markets before the Industrial Revolution, but many different parts of the world produced huge quantities of cotton, such as India especially, but also parts of Western Africa, Central America, and elsewhere. So why is it that slavery becomes so important to the history of cotton? And the explanation that I give in this book is that in the 18th century, in the early 19th century, European merchants and European imperial bureaucrats, despite all of their power, had a very, very hard time subordinating peasant producers in places such as India. They could not really dominate their labor and their land, and because they were unable to do so, they turned to the part of the world where they could dominate the land and the labor, and this was at first the Caribbean and Brazil, and later it was the United States.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about that? Because you write, the story about the United States is fascinating. How did the United States become such an important epicenter for cotton cultivation?
Right, so as I just mentioned, the United States was very marginal Cotton was not a particularly important crop in North America. The United States was completely marginal to the production of cotton for world markets. Indeed, when in the 1780s, when the first American-grown cotton arrived in the port of Liverpool, it was confiscated by the Customs House because they argued that it could not possibly be the growth of the United States. There was no association between the United States and cotton. Obviously, something that would drastically change in the 19th century when anybody who would think about cotton would think of the United States. And indeed, the United States dominated world markets. They produced about 85% of the global globally traded cotton crop by the 1850s. So they dominated these markets. So how did this change come about? And I explain that partly because for the reasons that I just mentioned, that it was very difficult for European merchants and statesmen to transform peasant agriculture in places such as India, Western Anatolia, Western Africa, but then also partly because areas in which cotton already was grown by slave labor, namely in the Caribbean and Brazil, faced certain limitations. It was difficult to expand cotton production in those areas of the world, partly, for example, because of the slave insurrection in Saint-Domingue in the early 1790s. Saint-Domingue, the present-day Haiti, was the world's most important cotton-growing place before the United States became important to the world of cotton. And the slave insurrection there in the early 1790s pretty much destroyed that industry. So at this point, it's in the 1790s that the United States becomes very suddenly and very significantly central to the global growing of cotton. And it does so because it has certain advantages that no other part of the world has. For one, there are huge, there's a lot of land which is very suitable for the growing of cotton, and the people who inhabited this land, Native Americans, are largely unable to resist the encroachment of settlers and of the American government. So the land can be made available for the growing of cotton, and it can be made available largely without any or very minimal cost to the settlers who are embarking upon plantation agriculture. At the same time, there are several million slaves living in the United States, and most of them before the cotton boom are engaged in the growing of tobacco for world markets. But after the American Revolution, it had become very difficult to export the tobacco from North America to Europe. And so in many ways, plantation agriculture in the American South was in decline. But that labor, all that labor of all these enslaved workers, was now available to grow some other crop. And as a result, about 1 million African Americans get sold from the Upper South into the Lower South and become engaged in cotton agriculture. So much so that by 1820, one in 13 Americans is an enslaved worker on a cotton plantation.
Wow. In his book, Sven Beckert writes that Native Americans understood the underlying foundations of the expanding military cotton complex. Upon removal in 1836, the chief of the Cherokees, John Ross, in a letter to Congress, decried that our property may be plundered before our eyes, violence may be committed on our persons, even our lives may be taken away, and there is none to regard our complaints. We are denationalized, we are disenfranchised, we are deprived of membership in the human family. Sven Beckert writes, the coercion and violence required to mobilize slave labor was matched only by the demands of an expansionist war against indigenous people. Nothing of this kind had ever been dreamed of in Gujarat or Anatolia. I'm reading from Sven Beckert's new book, Empire of Cotton, A Global History. Sven is professor of American history at Harvard University. And he says that in order to understand modern capitalism, we have to look at the rise of cotton and the history of cotton. So what questions do you have about cotton and how we got here today? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. To join in today's conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, the BBC's World Have Your Say. As Greeks and Europeans comes to term with the results, we'll hear from Europe and all around Europe on what it means. Do Greeks want to stay part of Europe in the Eurozone or break away from Brussels? Have we seen the first victory of an anti-austerity movement that will ripple across southern Europe to countries like Spain and Portugal? And what lessons do voters want Europe's leaders and Brussels bureaucrats to draw from this result? That's your World Heavier Say coming up at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Peter Richardson about his new books, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. For almost three decades, the Dead was America's most popular touring band. They just announced another concert, and people are already going crazy over this one. So three days of concerts. We will talk about why the band has been able to maintain so much popularity. That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about cotton. It's so ubiquitous as to be almost invisible. But according to today's guest, Harvard professor Sven Beckert, understanding cotton's history is key to understanding the origins of modern capitalism. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Harvey in San Francisco. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Yes, hello. You can hear me fine, right?
Yes.
Okay, when I was growing up, like in the late 50s and the 60s, we would use the phrase, my mother used it often, get your cotton picking hands off of such and such. And also on the Bugs Bunny show, he would always say that a lot. Of course, never realized what it referred to. Would you consider that a racist phrase to be avoided?
I really can't tell. Probably, but you know, it's by the late 19th century, and then by the 20th century, the growing of cotton became in the United States became as much an occupation for white farmers as it was for African Americans, and there was certainly enormous poverty among white cotton growing farmers as much as there was among African American cotton growing farmers. So, you know, maybe there is a racist intent in that wording, but there could also not be. I can't tell.
All right. Thank you for calling, Harvey. Let's go next to Linda in Muir Beach. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested in the conversation, specifically linking cotton to capitalism. And, you know, it's very refreshing to hear this perspective that's not talking about chemicals and so on and so forth. And I work with farmers involved with the Sustainable Cotton Project down in Fresno County in California. And I've worked with them for many years. And one of the things that I've noticed is, excuse me, I'm a little nervous. I wasn't expecting to get on straight onto the line. But what I've noticed is this is one of the most productive cotton systems on the planet. And it produces around about 4 bales an acre. And yet, Fresno County is one of the most impoverished counties in the U.S., with tremendous childhood poverty and, you know, annual incomes of less than $18,000 a year and so on and so forth. So I'm interested in the professor's perspective of that, that here we are in one of the richest countries in the world, one of the most productive systems, and yet that productive system is not benefiting the local community. And it seems to me that we need to look at what does this highly productive system in the name of capitalism, who does it really benefit? And I'd love to have his perspective on that.
All right. Thank you, Linda.
Right. Thank you, Linda. These are excellent questions. And again, they're very, very large. But to put this into historical perspective, I think you could argue that throughout the past 300 years of the expansion of cotton growing and cotton manufacturing, the growing of cotton pretty much always went along with devastating poverty. So This ranges from the growing of cotton by slaves in the Caribbean to eventually the growing of cotton by sharecroppers in places such as the United States or in Egypt or Brazil or India or China. In the 20th century, things obviously changed in some parts of the world, such as in the United States, where there was a massive mechanization of cotton agriculture, and so huge numbers of workers, farmers, were pushed off the land, and they ended up in industrial employment in cities and migrated out of the southern countryside. In other parts of the world, cotton growing is still extremely labor-intensive, such as in Western Africa or in Central Asia. And there it goes along with devastating devastating poverty in West Africa. The many cotton farmers make only about $1 a day for their labor. And I guess in the United States, presumably the people who own the land in Fresno and the machinery, they probably are doing fairly well. But throughout the countryside, but especially in the global cotton growing countryside, to this day there is it's characterized by devastating poverty.
Hmm. And in Uzbekistan, they're still using child labor.
Right. Yes. So in some parts of the world, child labor is still very significant to the harvesting of cottons. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Linda. Let's go next to Joseph in San Francisco. Hi, Joseph.
Hi, good morning. Professor Beckett, it is a pleasure. I am an African-American. I am three generations removed from bonded labor. Standard U.S. history, from my understanding, focuses on slavery being primarily in the South, and it wasn't until I did a little research that I found out something that was quite alarming to me, which happened in antebellum U.S. history. Yeah. 18 days after South Carolina seceded from the Union, January 7, 1861, Democratic Mayor of New York City, Fernando Wood, expressing his sympathy for the slaveholders and the people that he represented, I assume Wall Street, yeah, proposed to rule the secession of New York City from the United States. Sir, would you please give me some feedback on Wall Street's complicity with the Confederacy during this particular period of time? Thank you.
Okay, excellent. I mean, you are hitting on what I think is a very, very important point. We are often trained and we are taught that when we think about the history of slavery in the United States, we should largely be thinking about the history of the states that later became the Confederacy. So to think about the American South, and in some ways, this kind of cleanses the national history, because the history of the rest of the country then is depicted as a history of people who fought against the institution of slavery, eventually engaged in a bloody civil war, and eventually emancipated enslaved African Americans, the American South. This is a very attractive story. Obviously, it's not totally wrong. There were indeed significant numbers of abolitionists in the North, and there were many people fighting in the Union Army, partly because they wanted to get rid of the institution of slavery. So it's not completely wrong. But as you just mentioned, it is important to see, and you understand that very well if you look at the global history of cotton, that the history of slavery is not just to be understood as a local regional history, but it's very much a national and even global story. The expansion of slavery and of cotton agriculture in the American South would have been unimaginable, impossible, without the vast inflows of European capital and capital from New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, and other such places in the American South. The biggest merchants, the biggest bankers, the biggest financial firms all invested in cotton agriculture in the American South. This money enabled Southern planters to clear the land, to purchase the labor, and then also created the markets that allowed these planters to make profit of the labor of their enslaved workers. The cotton factories of where I'm here in Boston, in New England, they all relied on slave-grown cotton. The cotton factories in England and in continental Europe, everywhere, relied on slave-grown cotton. Partly it was only possible for European industrialists to undersell the producers of India because they had access to cheap slave-grown cotton that came from the American South. So I completely agree with you. And the profits that were made in that, this was the leading industry of the United States. This is why the United States in the first half of the 19th century mattered to the global economy. More than half of all American exports in the first half of the 19th century consisted of slave-grown cotton. Mm. And this is how the United States came to matter to the global economy. And so we must understand the history of slavery not just as a local history. We must understand it as a national history. We must understand it as a global history. And that, of course, also gives us the responsibility to think about the implications of this history to our contemporary moment.
You say also that it's important to understand the very close connection between the capitalist and the states. You write that it's easy to assume in our relentlessly branded world that today's vast corporations exist entirely on their own. Yet such a simplification misses the reality that historically, capitalists' greatest source of strength was their ability to rely on unusually powerful states.
Right. So I think often when we have when we have contemporary discussions about capitalism, often the discussion is structured along lines of the more markets you have, the less you have a state. The more capitalism you have, the less you have a state. The more you have a state, the less you have capitalism. But this is historically completely wrong. Capitalism, the emergence of capitalism and the spread of capitalism and the strengthening of capitalism went along with the vast strengthening of states and eventually of nation states. And the one cannot be imagined without the other. The expansion of slave agriculture in the American South, to just cite one example, is unimaginable without the important role of the United States government, for example, by making the land available on which this cotton was eventually grown, by investing in infrastructure, by creating a legal system. So even for that history, the state, the national state, the local state, the regional states is very, very crucial. If you look at the long history of industrialization, which is another important theme of the book, which we haven't spoken about so much yet, but if you look at the history of global industrialization, you can also see that the state, the involvement of the state in this project of industrialization is huge and very significant. So I think that teaches us that when you think about capitalism, you cannot not think about the state, and it's wrong to think about the state and capitalism as two forces that are in opposition to one another. They enable one another. They are part of the same thing.
Sven Beckert is a professor at Harvard and a historian. He's out with a new book, The Empire of Cotton, A Global History. More than 350 million people in over 100 countries are involved in the growing and manufacturing of cotton. Sven writes, slavery, colonialism, and forced labor, among other forms of violence, were not aberrations in the history of capitalism, but were at its very core the violence of market making, forcing people to labor in certain locations and in certain ways, has been a constant throughout the history of the Empire of Cotton, and we need to look at this in order to understand modern capitalism. So what questions do you have for Sven about cotton and the history of modern capitalism? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to, I have a couple of emails. Celine says, I have heard that to understand the true value of slaves and slavery in the U.S., you have to know what portion of the whole U.S. economy dealt with cotton. Can you comment on that, Sven?
Right. So I mean, as I mentioned, that is definitely true. And as I mentioned before, when it comes to the position of the United States in the global economy, if you look at the trade relationships of the United States in the first half of the 19th century, cotton is clearly the dominant commodity that goes into the foreign trade of the United States. And the United States, as I mentioned before, matters principally to the global economy because it does produce the crucial raw material for industrial production in Europe. If you look at the entire U.S. economy, if you look at, you know, let's say wheat farming and corn farming, and then also the budding manufacturing industries in the America that emerges in places like New England and the Mid-Atlantic states, then you will find that cotton agriculture is still important, but it's not the dominant part of that national economy. And what is especially important is when you look at the change from let's say the 1820s to the 1860s, slave grown cotton becomes ever less important to the total output of the national economy. And I think that has then a lot of this helps us explain the origins of the American Civil War. But this is an excellent point.
All right. Well, thank you for the email. Let's go next to Tristan in San Francisco. Hi, Tristan. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about hemp and the cotton lobby, because hemp is a more sustainable product, less water, et cetera, easier right. to. And so I'm wondering, you know, hemp hasn't been able to get into the economy like it should. So I'm wondering if you have any insights into that. And thank you.
No, I'm sorry. I don't have any insights. So this is a fascinating question. And actually, people have asked me about this before. So I really should read up on that. And probably you know more about it than I do. But my general sense would be, the production of hemp is also implicated in the production of as a fiber is implicated in the production of other things. But I would not think that this is decisive. My general what I think is probably the case is that the physical properties of clothing made from hemp is much less desired than the physical properties made from cotton fibers. But maybe you can correct me on that. I'm not entirely sure on that. But we know that throughout human history, hemp fiber has never been dominant.
Well, thank you for calling, Tristan. I'm glad you called because I'm going to propose a show about hemp.
Okay,
right now, there's a ban on hemp production in the U.S., but a bipartisan group of lawmakers just introduced a bill to put an end to that. So thank you for calling.
Okay, good. And I think in Europe, there's already hemp textiles, if I remember that correctly.
Right.
There is already, yeah.
Right. And we have to get our hemp from Canada.
Okay.
Okay, so thank you for calling. Let's hear from Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Rose. Just have a little bit of family history that's part of the whole story. My third great-grandfather was an entrepreneur who started bringing logs down the Delaware River to Chester, Pennsylvania, because there were mills. And then he married the daughter of a mill owner. And then he started bringing cotton from South Carolina to Pennsylvania around the 1830s, 1840s. I'm not exactly sure, 1830, 1850,
yeah.
But it was sort of this, you know, he's an entrepreneur. He just starts finding one opportunity, which is lumber for shipbuilding, and switches to cotton. So it's people in this is in southeastern Pennsylvania, they're making just as much money off of slave labor as those that are running the plantations. So,
Right.
Well, thanks for calling in, Chris.
Yeah. Thank you, Chris. This is a really interesting story you're telling there, and I think you know I think one has to be a little careful though. In some ways, you know, once your ancestors got involved in the manufacturing of cotton textiles, if I understood you correctly, they in some ways benefited from the institution of slavery because they drew on slave-grown cotton from the American South. But of course, they also built a system of production, of manufacturing, that in itself was not based on slavery and actually was quite different. It was, you know, based on wage labor and it was based on mostly on all these women and children entering the factories. So it is related, but it's also different. I think that is really important to keep in mind. And then, I think you will appreciate that in San Francisco. But if you think about the late 18th and early 19th century, if you wanted to do, the kind of cutting-edge thing as an entrepreneur, then this was to go into cotton manufacturing. This is the kind of internet industry of the early 19th century, and people, it was an industry that at the beginning wasn't particularly capital intensive. You needed some money to start out in cotton spinning and cotton weaving, but you didn't need that much. And so hundreds, thousands of people in England and France, in the German lands, in Italy, and the United States, including in Pennsylvania, as you just mentioned, went into this industry and engaged in the manufacturing of cotton textiles. And I think that really I think you can compare that actually quite well with the excitement that you find at your footsteps in Silicon Valley.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, Chris. Sven, we have just about 6 minutes left, and okay. I wanted to ask you to talk about how capitalism adapts, because you write that the constant reshuffling of the empire of cotton, ranging from its geography to its systems of labor, points toward an essential element of capitalism, its ability to constantly adapt again and again. You write about, you spend so many pages writing about how it adapted itself to the post-industrial revolution, the anti-colonial movements in India, Egypt, and Africa. What do we need to know about how capitalism adapts?
I think this relates to what I said earlier, that this is not a kind of abstract study of the immutable laws of capitalist development. This is really a history of capitalism. This is a history of capitalism in action. It introduces you to many colorful characters. It tells many stories. It touches down in many different parts of the world. And not everything is the same. Things do change. Things are quite different from one place to another. And so I'm suspicious of kind of notions that they're kind of universal laws to capitalism that are the same wherever you look and whenever you look. And so if you look at the history of the development of the cotton industry, you find, for example, that there is a constant reshuffling over the past 200 or 300 years as to which places are part of this global empire of cotton. We talked mostly about this empire of cotton as it emerges in the late 18th century and then flourishes in the 19th century, which basically combines industrialization in Europe with the expansion of slave agriculture in the United States, the importation of workers from Africa, and the creation of markets in places such as India, Latin America, and elsewhere. So this is a particular moment in the history of the cotton industry, and with it in the history of capitalism. But then, if you look at the world today, it has changed completely. Today, cotton manufacturing plays basically no role anymore in continental Europe or the United States. Nearly all cotton manufacturing today takes place in Asia, and particularly in China. The world's largest grower of cotton today is the country of China. Textiles, as you know, are produced in places such as Bangladesh and Vietnam and Cambodia and elsewhere. So the geography of this empire of cotton has radically changed. And so this is something that the book wants to emphasize, that capitalism is kind of a state of constant revolution. And in some ways, the history of the cotton industry shows that. And it also combines new ways of producing things. So slavery in 1850 was at the very center of this global empire of cotton. But today, obviously, slavery doesn't play a role anymore.
And here we are today. You write that the owners of cotton, the cotton growing business in the U.S., have collectively received subsidies of more than $35 billion between 1995 and 2010. Workers in Bangladesh stitch together clothing under absurdly dangerous conditions for very low wages, while consumers in the U.S. and Europe purchase these pieces with abandon at prices that often seem impossibly low, very low. You write about Walmart and, these multinationals that are selling these cheap clothes. How far can this kind of capitalism continue on the backs of, for example, people in Bangladesh, people in Vietnam, Cambodia?
Yeah, that's difficult to answer because that would mean predicting the future, which is something that historians are notoriously bad at. So I don't think I want to predict the future. But, you know, if history teaches us something, then it is, you know, at least when it comes to the history of the cotton industry, is that the search for ever cheaper labor is kind of a constant. This is something that has unfolded over the past 200 or 300 years. And sometimes conditions have improved, and they largely have improved because workers organized in unions and other such things. But basically, the history of the cotton industry is a history of the race to the bottom. And but you know, then the as I also mentioned in the book, the space of the planet itself has its limits. Mm. Eventually, there's not going to be a place where you can do things even cheaper. And you know, maybe we have reached that point.
Well, and here we are in 2015. Oxfam just came out with a report saying that the richest 1% will own more than 50% of the world's wealth by next year.
Wow, wow, that's an impressive number. And in some ways, I think Empire of Cotton helps you understand how we came to create a world in which that is the case.
Sven, we have about a couple minutes left. How do you think people should think about capitalism today at a time when the conversation tends to be, you know, fairly shallow? You were saying that we get these numbers and we look at it in pieces, but we don't really give it this sort of long view and look at its very ugly and brutal history.
Right. So I think that the order, first of all, I think we need to have a conversation on capitalism. It is something that is so important in structuring our world and our lives that it is, you know, no matter how we stand on these issues, it is important to grapple with capitalism, and it is important to grapple with its history. I think, you know, and this is maybe my professional bias as a historian, I think you cannot really understand the world that we live in today by just looking at the world we live in today. I think you need to have a long historical perspective to understand where we are right now. And I think also the Empire of Cotton teaches you that you cannot even begin to understand capitalism, including contemporary capitalism, by just looking at one particular part of the world. Let's say just by looking at the United States. You need to look at it always in global perspective. And then more generally, I think it does show you that, for example, you know, one of the core arguments of the book is to show how states, how politics, how social movements make a difference in the history of capitalism. And, you know, I agree with you that the story that I'm telling is perhaps not particularly uplifting, but I think it is uplifting in two particular ways. It is uplifting in that it chronicles, the book also chronicles, among everything else, that humans have an enormous creativity, and they have been able to invent new ways of producing something that is a fundamental human need, namely textiles and clothing, in ever more productive ways. And then the book also shows, as I mentioned, that politics and governments matter. And of course, in many parts of the world, politics and governments are subject to democratic control in one way or another. So
well,
I think there are possibilities.
Well, Sven, we got full lines. So clearly this is something people want to talk about. We'd love to have you back. Sven Beckert is professor of history at Harvard University. His new book is Empire of Cotton, A Global History. Sven, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. It was great to be there.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What explains the Grateful Dead's durable popularity? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with Peter Richardson about his new book, No Simple Highway, A Cultural History of the Grateful Dead. For almost three decades, the Dead was America's most popular touring band. No Simple Highway asked the simple question, why? Richardson argues that the band tapped three utopian ideals, ecstasy, mobility, and community. So what explains the Dead's continued appeal today? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and
support
you.
For Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org.
Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.